Hello and welcome to Relay Theology. My name is Justin Schieber, and today I'm responding to a recent video by Gavin Ortlund over at Truth Unites on the topic of divine hiddenness. Why, if a perfectly loving God exists, is there such a thing as non-resistant non-belief? The video is an hour and 10 minutes long, and it's framed as a response to Alex O'Connor, the cosmic skeptic, who has defended the argument on several occasions. Because I'm in the middle of a series on the argument from divine hiddenness, and because Gavin engages directly with some of Schellenberg's writing, I thought I would interact with at least some of what Gavin has to say on the topic. Let me just start off by saying that I really do like Gavin. We've had a few brief interactions. In fact, we almost had a full in-person debate, but scheduling issues got in the way. He's a thoughtful and kind person, and this video of his is no exception. And so I want to use this video as an opportunity to contribute to the discussion by offering some clarifications of at least Schellenberg's argument and some replies to some of Gavin's objections to it. My hope is that these contributions will add something of value to the discussion between Gavin and Alex and anyone else who may be interested to learn a bit more about the argument from divine hiddenness. After giving some history of the hiddenness argument, Gavin has this to say.
The one thing we can't say, the one thing we know we can rule out right away, is any dismissiveness toward this issue, any glibness, complacency, formulaic answers that lack compassion. All of that will be disastrous. This argument, and Alex and his articulation of it, Schellenberg and others, puts its finger on a real human struggle that every honest person should be humble before.
Gavin is inviting his viewers to take the hiddenness problem seriously. He wants to face the issue head on. He's not going to sit content with some stock replies that he's heard before, right? He prefers instead to develop his own thinking by digging deeper. And his motivation doesn't appear to, you know, arise simply from the fact that he needs to rebut an atheistic argument. It also seems to arise from a clear compassion for the non-believer and a desire to more deeply understand God. In preparation for the video, Gavin notes that he's read both of Schellenberg's books on hiddenness, and he's also read a number of other books and articles on the topic. And so this video kind of summarizes where his head is currently at regarding the problem of divine hiddenness. Ultimately, you may be unsurprised to learn that he believes that the argument fails, and he presents three main reasons or objections, or what he refers to as theses, for why he thinks that the argument fails. From where I sit, though, none of them, as stated, pose any real problem for Schellenberg's argument. In any case, that's enough of me. Here's Gavin presenting the first thesis against the argument.
Thesis 1. The problem of divine hiddenness, especially in its stronger deductive forms, tends to over-centralize and sentimentalize divine love while under-emphasizing other divine attributes like divine transcendence. Let's call this thesis the expectations about divine love thesis. So if we take this premise that if a perfectly loving God exists, then there exists a God who is always open to a personal relationship with any finite person. The concern that I would like to articulate here in this thesis is not just with the truth of the premise, but also more probingly with how we could ever measure whether that is true. To put it simply, who gets to decide what a perfectly loving God will do?
Gavin continues.
Now, with this phrase, perfectly loving, a certain set of expectations is being placed upon God. As Michael Ray puts it, the problem of divine hiddenness, like the problem of evil, is fundamentally a problem of violated expectations. But I think more caution is needed in setting these expectations. Like the problem of evil, when it's stated in a deductive form, as Schellenberg, for example, puts it, it's problematic because it assumes to know what God would do. But given that God is infinite and we are finite, it wouldn't actually be surprising at all for God to relate to us in ways that are surprising. And it may well be that there are reasons for divine hiddenness that we can't currently see.
So what Gavin is urging us to do here is to approach the concept of the divine with a bit of humility. And honestly, how could anyone really object to that, right? If God exists, it would be the absolute height of irrationality to think that we could know everything that he would be moved to do. But while I can appreciate Gavin's caution here, I am sure he would agree that it would be a mistake to therefore conclude that just because we can't know everything God would do, we therefore can know nothing that God would do. And so I just don't see that we've been given any reason to think that the premise in question is incompatible with an appropriate caution and humility. The premise never claims, for example, that God would never surprise us in how he chooses to relate to us, nor does it gain its purchase merely from our failure to see reasons of some sort or other, as Gavin seems to suggest here. Rather, the premise simply states that if a perfectly loving God exists, there exists a God who's always open to a personal relationship with any finite person. Now, to further address Gavin's concerns, however, we need to kind of briefly rehearse some of the reasoning that Schellenberg uses in support of premise one. That reasoning always begins with reflection on the concept of love. The concept of love is like any other concept. It gains its meaning from our use of it. We can, in an effort to better grasp the essence of personal love, catalog what are understood as the best forms of love, kind of archetype examples of love. And you could find serious contenders in the love between like a parent and a child, or that love that exists between participants in a long-lasting marriage. According to Schellenberg, when we do reflect on the nature of love as directed toward persons, we can come to appreciate that while it includes benevolence, where benevolence is construed as like a general goodness or a giving disposition, like wanting what's best for one's beloved, that's not all there is to love, nor is it even the deepest aspect of love. Person-directed love distinctly aims at personal relationship for its own sake. Aiming at just any sort of broadly defined relationship simply won't do. Instead, Schellenberg emphasizes the necessity of a personal relationship defined as, quote, a conscious and reciprocal relationship that is positively meaningful, allowing for deep sharing, in part because it alone provides the context in which the benevolent aspect of love can be most fully realized, enjoyed, jointly acknowledged, and appreciated by the participants. And to be clear, benevolence can provide gifts or valuable experiences from a kind of abstract or impersonal distance. But again, to think that's sufficient for love is to fail to understand the distinctly relational aim at the core of what it means to love another person. Given love's relational aim, we can also see that when one loves another, one is at the very least minimally open to being in a relationship with the other, allowing the other to share in one's life. Now, what is this minimal openness? Schellenberg writes, quote, "One makes sure there's nothing one ever does or fails to do that would have the result of making such relationship unavailable to the other, preventing her from being able to relate personally to one when she tries to do so." Now, with these insights about love in place, we can join them up with the concept of God as a perfectly loving person. And then when we do that, we generate premise one. Again, if a perfectly loving God exists, there exists a God who's always open to a personal relationship with any finite person. Now, of course, that was a brief sketch of the defense of premise one, but with it in place, we can see where Gavin's first thesis falls short. It never directly deals with any of the conceptual analysis used to motivate this first premise. Indeed, it is only after we do the relevant conceptual analysis that we may then take those results and explore their implications for other terrain, and insofar as our exploration turns to the idea of God as unsurpassably loving, we need to allow that this conceptual assignment of being loving must, as Schellenberg suggests, bring certain things with it, even if caution properly recommends that such expectations should be minimal. So, regarding Gavin's first thesis, if one has done the necessary reflection on the concept of love, as Schellenberg has done, then one can exhibit proper humility while still acknowledging the entailments that they've discovered with that analysis, like those featured in the highlighted premise. Humility does not make them disappear. Now, maybe more closely examining Schellenberg's analysis of love will expose where he's gone wrong. But if Gavin wants to object to the premise on that basis, he needs to identify where in Schellenberg's analysis a mistake occurs rather than assuming that one has. And with that, we turn to Gavin's second thesis.
Thesis 2, the problem of divine hiddenness, especially in its stronger, deductive forms, exaggerates or speaks with unwarranted confidence about non-resistant non-belief. Let's call this point the non-resistant non-belief naivety thesis. Okay, now this point is going to apply to Schellenberg more than Alex. Schellenberg puts his argument as a deductive argument, that is, an argument in which the premises entail the conclusion, and he speaks very confidently of it, especially in his 2015 book.
For those unfamiliar, another key premise of the argument states that some finite persons are or have been non-resistantly in a state of non-belief in relation to the proposition that God exists. I think that for most, this premise will strike them as immediately obvious, or at least likely. Schellenberg himself writes as if this is the least controversial premise. However, Gavin thinks that this confidence is unwarranted, and I think that exploring some of Gavin's comments here, his concerns, can occasion some helpful clarification. And we can start with how he understands Schellenberg's concept of non-resistant non-belief.
Non-resistant non-belief is the position of those who are open to believing in God and capable of believing in God, but don't believe in God.
Now, as stated, this is not correct. But in fairness to Gavin, this line appears to be unscripted, and it's pretty close to accurate. In any event, it isn't as clear as it perhaps should be in this context. Gavin is certainly right that for someone to have the relevant sort of non-belief, they must have the requisite capacities and yet nonetheless fail to believe that God exists. The non-resistance component is what needs more attention here. Contrary to popular belief, the phrase non-resistant non-belief does not refer to the position of a non-believer who is completely devoid of any negative attitudes about God. Rather, a non-resistant non-believer, at least in Schellenberg's sense, is someone who, one, fails to believe in God, and two, the failure was not caused by their own resistance to God. Now, the causal component here is very important because resistance to, or negative attitudes about something, can manifest in a variety of different ways, and not all of them cause one to fail to believe in that something. And so someone with these lesser forms of resistance would still be non-resistant in the relevant sense. What then is the relevant type of resistance so capable of bringing about non-belief? Well, the answer here is self-deceptive resistance. Schellenberg explains, the self-deceptive resistance required would include a desire component, a desire not to be in a relationship with God, or else to be in a condition incompatible with relationship with God, but it would also involve actions or omissions, at least mental ones, in support of such a desire. Now, one reason you might believe there are or have been at least some non-resistant non-believers is that a categorical denial of any and all non-resistant non-belief is plainly implausible to you. Indeed, the premise only requires a single instance in all of human history, and we just saw that such a categorical denial requires attributing self-deceptive motives and actions or omissions to each and every person who has ever for a time failed to believe in God. Considering the size and the varied nature of the entire history of the human population stretching back 200,000 years, the required categorical denial of non-resistant non-belief is simply not going to be a live option for somebody who values humility. Another reason you might think Schellenberg is right regarding the existence of at least some non-resistant non-belief is the self-report testimony attesting to their existence. Consider the self-report testimony from people like Alex O'Connor, or perhaps others in your life who claim to not believe in God but wish that they could. Given the sheer numbers of people throughout history who have wanted to believe in God but have failed to do so, or who had once believed but lost their faith in the face of tragedy or some other factors against their will, Schellenberg's minimal claim seems pretty hard to deny. Now, to his credit, Gavin does not outright deny the existence of non-resistant non-belief.
And I just want to encourage people not to psychoanalyze other people. That's not productive or helpful. I think it's better to just take Alex's words at face value. Now, I'm not going to be arguing that there is no non-resistant non-belief.
Instead, Gavin himself appears to be somewhat sympathetic to Schellenberg's claim that non-resistant non-belief exists, but worries that Schellenberg exaggerates the degree of it. Gavin worries that some of the arguments that Schellenberg uses in support of the premise are confused. But before we address Gavin's next point, it's important again to emphasize that Schellenberg only needs a single instance of non-resistant non-belief. So even if it can be shown that Schellenberg is exaggerating the number, this won't by itself damage the argument. Ultimately, what matters for the hiddenness argument is that some non-resistant non-belief exists. After that is recognized, the exact number is just not important.
But I do want to say I think Schellenberg and perhaps others exaggerate the degree of that. Schellenberg sees that as very common. He almost sees non-resistant non-belief as kind of the default. So for example, in the ancient world, before Abraham, say 10,000 years before Christ, he speaks of people that in that time and he says, these are people who don't believe in God, and how could they be resistant? It's not even possible, since resistance of God presupposes thinking about God, and their whole picture of the world is shaped in such a way that thinking about God just won't happen.
Now, for some context here, Schellenberg gives several reasons for his claim that non-resistant non-belief exists. And one of his reasons relies on evidence that strongly suggests that monotheism is a relatively recent development in human history. Schellenberg makes two separate claims here, and it's important to keep them separate. First, he says that many of these ancient peoples don't believe in God. And secondly, he claims that it is their ignorance of the concept of God, rather than their resistance to it, that is the cause of their non-belief. Again, this causal component is very important. He then concludes that these people are non-resistant non-believers in the relevant sense of the argument. Now, Gavin objects to this by saying,
but I think this is problematic. Schellenberg appears to be assuming that until monotheistic Abrahamic religion arose, people could not have had a sufficient knowledge of God to be resistant to that knowledge. That is very far from clear.
Well, not exactly. Schellenberg is not just saying that their not having the concept prevents them from resisting it. He's making a far broader point. He's saying that their not having the concept prevents them from even thinking about the concept. It prevents them from even getting to a place where they might consider it, regardless of whether they ultimately resist or embrace it.
That is very far from clear. Many particular individual ancient people did have a conception, and even ancient religions, of a supreme deity, even a creator deity, who was superior to all the other deities. So there is that. Now, Schellenberg anticipates that, and he says, yeah, but he quotes Robin Wright's work to the effect that, yeah, but this supreme deity didn't control the other gods. But the thing is, you don't need to have perfect knowledge of God in order to have enough knowledge of God to be resistant to that knowledge.
I gotta say, I must disagree with Gavin's interpretation here. Here is the relevant passage from Schellenberg's 2015 book where he gets this from. Quote, another objection I anticipate says that the people I'm talking about did in a way believe in God, because they believed in one divine being higher than all others. But as Robert Wright shows, with a nice survey of scientific evidence in his book, The Evolution of God, this was not the case in all hunter-gatherer societies, and where it was, the high god, though in some vague sense more important than other supernatural beings, and often a creator god, was not a god that controls the other gods. But then Schellenberg continues here. Quote, more importantly, the high god wasn't elevated in a moral sense. In hunter-gatherer societies, says Wright, the connection we are inclined to make between God and good is just about unknown. Now that last bit about the connection between God and good is key to understanding Schellenberg's point here. Yes, Gavin is right in one sense. One does not need an exhaustive understanding of the concept of God in order to believe in some way that God exists. But Schellenberg is showing this point to be irrelevant, because even if We don't need an exhaustive understanding of the concept of God. We still require a sufficient understanding of the concept of God. And Schellenberg's main point is that, one, many hunter-gatherer societies did not have a concept of a high God. And two, even in those that did have the concept, it was not conceived of as having any discernible connection to goodness. So while many of the people in these ancient hunter-gatherer societies may have believed in a supernatural deity of some sort, they simply did not have a concept anywhere near that of a morally perfect God, such that resistance to the former could remotely constitute resistance to the latter. And for that reason, we should recognize them as clear examples of non-resistant non-believers. Next, Gavin turns to some comments regarding the methods of revelation that Schellenberg says God might use.
Schellenberg arguably focuses only on special revelation here, to the neglect of general revelation through creation and conscience, which often yield a dim or indirect knowledge of God.
Now, I completely disagree that this is arguably the case. Schellenberg is explicit in nearly everywhere he discusses the hiddenness argument that the provision of belief in God, which again he argues is necessary for an explicit and reciprocal relationship with God, could occur in many different ways. Quote, "There are in fact various ways in which non-resistant people might legitimately become and stay believers in God in a world in which God really exists and is inclined to have them be believers. Evidence of events from around the world that seem to everyone who non-resistantly considers them to be, on balance, best explained by the activity of God could be made universally available. This would not be psychologically intrusive, even when effective in producing and maintaining belief in God, or everyone everywhere could be gifted with a continuing quiet sense of God's existence on par with belief in other minds or belief in an external world. This wouldn't need to be intrusive or constantly in the forefront of one's awareness, any more than is the belief in God of people today in regions or households where the existence of God is just taken for granted, along with the existence of trees and horses and people. Belief could, of course, also be produced through a more direct experience of God. One can imagine, for example, a powerful initial experience of God's presence that everyone has, followed by a lingering background awareness. And of course, religious experience is the sort of thing that could be modulated by God to fit people's circumstances as they changed in ways we have seen suggested by Pascal. This means that for those who are especially sensitive or vulnerable to moral influence, the sense of God's presence could recede or even be withdrawn altogether in moments of temptation. The possibilities here are indeed limited only by the imagination. Ultimately, what matters for the hiddenness argument isn't the way that God ensures belief, but that he would. Next, Gavin explores the idea that personal relationships don't require the participants to believe that the other exists.
Now, this might seem strange, but a lot of very good philosophers have argued for this. Michael Ray says, it is possible to participate in a relationship with God without knowing that one is doing so, and indeed, without knowing or even believing that God exists. You might wonder, well, how can that work? Well, here's how C. Stephen Evans puts it using an analogy. Suppose I am in a dark room and suddenly come in contact with a furry animal. The animal is in fact my dog, and thus I am aware of my dog through the sense of touch. However, it is clearly possible that I might not recognize my dog as my dog, or even as a dog. I might mistakenly think he is some other dog, or even that he is some other kind of animal. I think that something similar is true in the case of God as well. It is possible to be aware of God without being aware of God as God.
Notice that if Schellenberg's claim was that one's having explicit belief that God exists is necessary for one to be in relationship with God, these objections would be clearly successful. That's because they all identify various ways by which one might, in some broad, abstract sense, relate to God, without believing or even having thought of the concept of God. Again, if that were Schellenberg's claim, these objections would by themselves spell the end of the conversation. But if you recall, that is definitely not his claim. Rather, Schellenberg is clear that if the ultimate is spelled out in a personal way, if we are talking about a personal God, and if that person is perfectly loving toward any finite persons that exist, such a God will be open to a conscious and reciprocal relationship, one that allows for deep sharing with those persons. God's being open to that sort of relationship with his loved ones at a time requires that his loved ones be in possession of explicit belief that God exists at that time. Now we turn to the last of Gavin's three theses against divine hiddenness.
Okay, now please hear me. These first two theses have been very modest. We've mainly tried to just knock the argument from divine hiddenness down a few pegs, showing that as a deductive argument that requires the conclusion, it's overstated. But we haven't yet necessarily given a really full or satisfying answer. So now let's get to the heart of the matter. Thesis 3. It is plausible that God has morally sufficient reasons for revealing himself in just the way that he has. So as an entry point, let's consider alternative ways that God could reveal himself to us. Suppose God were to do a miracle every day at 5 p.m. where the clouds formed the words, "I am God, I exist." Would this be the ideal way for God to relate to us? I want to give two reasons why it's plausible, why that's not the case, and overtly miraculous scenarios like that aren't necessarily better than a partially hidden revelation. Number one, a partially hidden revelation is better for us, and number two, it's more in line with the divine nature.
Now, as we saw earlier, Schellenberg's argument from divine hiddenness never once claims that if a perfectly loving God exists, he must perform an overtly miraculous public revelation for everyone. This kind of reply, at least if intended for Schellenberg, demonstrates nothing but an unfamiliarity with his argument, right? But in fairness to Gavin, though, maybe others do make this claim. And I wouldn't be surprised if that were the case. In any event, we can perhaps charitably restate or steelman the objection so that it is more applicable to Schellenberg's argument by reframing it as reasons God might want to withhold belief from some instead of reasons why God wouldn't treat the sky like a revelatory jumbotron. So Gavin's first reason why perfect love might sometimes hide from its beloved by withholding belief is because, plausibly, it may not be good for us. Here's Gavin.
Pascal points out that our fundamental need in relation to God is not ignorance, but sin. A full unveiling wouldn't touch that. He says God wishes to move the will rather than the mind. Perfect clarity would help the mind and harm the will. If God gave perfect clarity, we might be convinced, but not be softened. We might know God, but relate to him in pride. And God is interested not just that we believe in him, but why we believe in him, how we relate to him. For Pascal, a true relationship with God requires humility, and that is better served by the diligent searching that is involved in a partial revelation than it is by the complacent awareness that would be brought about by a constant bombardment of direct miracles.
So here Gavin suggests that the strategy of withholding belief may be what God uses to get what he wants in terms of what is ultimately good for us, bringing us into a deep humility by breaking our pride. The idea here is that God's hiddenness is done out of God's love for us rather than in spite of it. Unsurprisingly, I disagree here. First, on the point of what's good for us, I could not disagree more. If there exists a metaphysically, axiologically, and soteriologically ultimate, and that ultimate is a person, what possible better thing could there be for us than to be in an explicit, conscious, reciprocal relationship with that person? If God exists, belief in this fact would be essential to the recognition of one's cosmic value and fulfillment as a created person. How could it be anything other than the best thing for finite persons, that they correctly believe about themselves that they are first, created by a perfectly loving God, and secondly, that God is open to relationship with their mere finite selves? Only then can their creaturely potential be seen in full, unfiltered technicolor. But that's just regarding what's good for us. There's also the concern that the hiddenness strategy that God might employ here appears on its face incompatible with the notion of perfect love that we developed earlier. First, recall that reflection on the nature of love allows us to see that when love is directed at another relationship-capable person, it is necessarily aimed at a personal relationship with that person for its own sake. If love entails a minimal openness, as earlier argued, then surely perfect love must entail it too. Second, the goodness of bringing about character development in one's beloved, of breaking their pride and of softening their heart, that simply does not require the absence of a personal relationship with God or the explicit belief that occasions it. Such goods can be acquired perfectly well within a pre-existing context of explicit and reciprocal relationship. But there lies the issue. If those goods can be acquired within such a relationship, then they fail to constitute any reason at all why a perfectly loving person would hide for their sake. Indeed, there are other ways, relationship-compatible ways, to elicit the desired progress. Now, might these alternative methods bring with them tension, confusion, or periods of anger? Absolutely, but no personal relationship is sunshine and roses for its entirety. Relationships between humans are not static, frozen states of affairs lacking in dynamic narrative. Indeed, those dynamic features, the highs and the lows of our relationships, can often be what adds to their value. Here it can be useful to distinguish between having belief that God exists and experiencing God's presence. Now, Gavin may be right that an overwhelming presence of God may actually be less than ideal or even incompatible with personal growth. This seems somewhat plausible. I mean, I think of helicopter parents, right? So-called helicopter parents that may, in their desire to protect their children, end up actually hurting them because they fail to instill certain virtues or develop certain aspects of character. And so some degree of experiential distance may at times be necessary. And if that's true, though, why can't an omnipotent being who perfectly loves his finite creatures modulate the degree to which he is experientially present to them while also preserving their belief that he exists? And if this seems odd, notice that we do not fail to believe that our friends exist when they, you know, become experientially distant when they go on vacation or something. Similarly, God could kind of go on vacation experientially from us when we act entitled or proud or resist some moral lesson he's attempting to convey. Such divine strategies could mirror those of human parents who send their children to their rooms or give them the cold shoulder so that their children are kind of forced to reflect on their actions and their proper role in the relationship. The second part of Gavin's third thesis was that it may be that withholding massive public miracles is more in line with God's nature. I'm honestly not entirely sure how to interpret this objection to make it relevant to the argument. Is the idea supposed to be that because God is wholly other, we can only ever have an incomplete concept of God? If that's the case, we've already addressed that worry. We can agree that our concept of God will be incomplete, but it's not clear how this could constitute an objection to the argument. So that concludes my response to Gavin Ortland's video on the argument from divine hiddenness. I don't think Gavin has undermined in any way Schellenberg's argument from divine hiddenness. That said, I really did enjoy watching Gavin jump headlong into the literature on this topic, and I thank him for that. I especially love the personal bits he put in the video about his own struggles with hiddenness generally. I remember the turmoil I experienced when I was struggling with doubt. That's not an easy feeling. Anyway, I hope that people found this video helpful or interesting, especially those with an interest in the hiddenness argument. Lastly, if you are new to Relay Theology and you want to dive deeper on this and other arguments, follow the channel and enter a dynamic personal relationship with us. Thank you for watching. Please hit like and subscribe to keep up with future content. Music is by Casserole, a Chicago-based band, and used with permission. If you appreciate the content and the tone of what Relay Theology does, defending atheistic philosophy online and in person, please consider making a small recurring donation to our Patreon for early access to our content and other opportunities. Comments, questions, criticisms, and requests can be sent in audio form to relaytheology@gmail.com for possible inclusion into future episodes. Someone is taking a shower currently. Special thanks to our patrons, Charles Hoffer, Tyler Bimrose, Jason, Robin Willems, Ed Atkinson, Kim Bishkovsky, Anthony Lawson, Jeff Rubinoff, and Brandon McCleary. Bye.